Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's premature boasts about a successful summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, which has yet to take place, and his tweet, "Korean War to End," which has prompted Senator Lindsey Graham to gush on Fox News, quote, "If this happens, President Trump deserves a Nobel Peace Prize." Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist David K. Johnston, the best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump and his latest, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America, joins us to discuss whether Trump could get a second term. We will assess the state of the Democratic opposition, which in large part is depending upon Trump to either melt down and be dragged out of the Oval Office in a straitjacket or be dragged out of the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit by Robert Mueller. With the crowd shouting "Nobel, Nobel" last night at a Trump rally in Michigan, at the same time a comedian was trashing the president at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, which Trump boycotted for a second time, we will explore the separate universes in American politics, with Trump haters disgusted at Republicans on one side and Trump lovers who hate Democrats on the other. Then we'll look into the extent that Donald Trump is being played by Kim Jong-un, whose charm offensive with the South Koreans appears to be undercutting the leverage Trump has in terms of pressuring North Korea with sanctions and maintaining military threats when the two Koreas are talking peace. Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University and author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations and North Korea and Mongolia, joins us to discuss what kind of deal is likely to emerge from the forthcoming Trump-Kim summit. Then finally, we'll get an assessment of what denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula could mean and whether greater engagement between the two Koreas could lead to the opening of North Korea to the outside world, and speak with Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University. He joins us to discuss whether either of the summits will lead to the North demobilizing its outsized standing army and the firing of thousands of bemedaled generals and the removal of hundreds of thousands of rockets and artillery tubes targeting Seoul. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He has lectured on economics, journalism, and tax policy on every continent except Antarctica, and is a former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and he recently co-founded DC Report, and his latest book just out is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thanks. Happy to be on again with you.
Well, thanks, David. And what do you make of the contrast of Donald Trump at a rally in Michigan with the crowd shouting "Nobel, Nobel," referring to the possibility that Trump will get a Nobel Peace Prize for his summit meeting with Kim Jong-un? At the same time, a comedian was trashing him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which Trump had boycotted for a second term.
Well, the most interesting aspect of this, frankly, is the hostile news coverage of the comedian who's gotten pretty critically worded news stories over her choice of jokes and a number of which fell flat with the audience. In Michigan, you know, let's not forget there's always a contingent of Americans who really would like an authoritarian regime. Their individual liberty and the betterment of society is less important to them than having a leader who makes them feel good and tells them what to do. And Donald is a master at that, and anybody who thinks that he will not get a second term isn't thinking clearly. I think his odds of getting a second term are better than 1 in 3.
Well, you can't beat somebody with nobody, and that seems to be the Democrats' problem, doesn't it? I mean,
well, that's one of their problems, Ian. We know the Democrats are opposed to Trump, and we know that if they are in control of the House, which we hope they will, should hope they will be, even Republicans should hope they will be, come next year. What are they for? I mean, I know what the Republicans are for. The Republicans are for the rich will not invest and create jobs unless we give them more money. So let's cut their taxes and let's finance that by taking away from children, the disabled, the elderly, and the poor, that is, people who can't fight back.
And school teachers, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know what the Democrats are for. quite seriously. I mean, are they for unions, which, as Pope Francis says, there is no economic justice without unions? Are they for more funding for higher education and for even elementary schools and whatnot? And if so, how are they going to finance it? Are they for absolutely protecting, if not improving, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? I don't know. And I think that's a real serious problem. Plus, you know, the leadership we see on Capitol Hill is a lot older than I am, and I'm 69 years old. I'd be a youngster among that group if I were in Congress, which I don't want to be. But it is time for the Democrats to get some younger leadership, people in their 40s and 50s, and people who are solidly committed to building a better future, not stealing from the future so the rich can have more today.
Shades of the Soviet Politburo. So, what though, since you've studied this man and covered him for many decades, David K. Johnston, Michael D'Antonio, Trump's biographer, said, "We're dealing with a person who's psychologically and categorically different from any previous president. He may be the most successful con man in history, atop the most powerful nation in history. He has prevailed in a way no other spinner of tales has prevailed."
Well, I say the same thing in my book, it's even worse than you think, that Michael does, but in stronger language. And interestingly, all of Trump's biographers, Harry Hurt, Gwenda Blair, who did the Trump family, Tim O'Brien, who was my colleague at the New York Times, Michael D'Antonio, and Wayne Barrett, who sadly died the day before Trump took office and was the first journalist to get onto Trump, we're all in basic agreement about who he is. He's a con artist. He is incredibly ignorant. He just makes things up. He fills in the blanks. Donald is not the only person I've dealt with in 50 years of journalism like this, but he is one of those people who, whatever he says, that is reality to him. And no set of facts will interfere with his reality. And, of course, that means he's totally flexible. So he's for this today and then against it tomorrow. This is a clear and present danger to our society. But I'll tell you what really scary to me, I spent the last 15 weeks on the road speaking about Trump. And the number of people that I am encountering who believe that, in fact, he is our savior, that he is the future of America, and we desperately need him, that he is doing all the right things, and that the news media really are the enemy of the people, that the Democrats really are vile and awful people who hate America. It's extraordinary how many of them I meet. I've lectured to the executive boards or regional boards of a number of unions that have brought me in, and I go to the union meetings to talk about how do you deal with all your younger members who say, we don't need the union, and who support Trump. And this is very, very troubling about social cohesion and about the future of this country.
And again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He has lectured on economics, journalism, and tax policy on every continent except Antarctica, and is the former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. And he recently co-founded DC Report. And his latest book just out is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Well, that, of course, is rallying at the press has been very successful for him. President Nixon did it in private. Trump does it in public. And it certainly is resonating. And what's your sense of at that rally? Not only, of course, were they shouting Nobel, Nobel, and as I mentioned in the opening, Senator Lindsey Graham was gushing on Fox News the other night that Trump could win the Nobel Peace Prize. But in the rally, Trump also went after Senator Tester, who revealed information detrimental to Ronny Jackson, the White House physician who Trump elevated as a nominee for the second biggest government department, the Veterans Administration, and revealed that he'd been nicknamed the Candy Man for handing out pills, etc. What Trump did say, though, was, I think, extraordinarily flimsy. He said he said he claimed that he has dirt on Senator Tester, but he wouldn't reveal it. Well, give me a break. If this guy is he's not self-restrained, is he? I mean, if he's got something, he's going to say it, isn't he?
Joseph McCarthy 2.0 in the person of Donald Trump, who's, after all, his, as he called him, his second father and mentor, was the notorious Roy Cohn, who was the attack dog lawyer for Joe McCarthy when he claimed, you know, oh, I have a list of 244 communists in the U.S. Army and other nonsense. That's how Donald operates. You know, Donald calling on a U.S. senator to resign because he disagrees with him about the qualifications of Trump's doctor is an example of what should be scaring the gee-willikers out of people. Donald Trump is a dictator in waiting. His own words show that he does not understand the duties, powers, and limits of the presidency. And so far, he's been able to get away with it a great deal. And when he does something where a federal judge says you can't do that, he attacks the legitimacy of the judge. When the FBI does what it's supposed to do, he attacks the legitimacy of law enforcement. I mean, this is a man who has no business holding any public office, not even, you know, Burbank City Council. And Donald Trump is demonstrating every day this, but at the same time, there's a long winning streak in America of people who they want an authoritarian leader, they want someone they think is tough and throwing his weight around, and who claims credit for everything. And by the way, in the North Korea situation, which I know you're going to discuss with some of the guests, Ian, if there is a resolution to the still existing state of war between the two Koreas, Donald Trump will have had relatively little to do with it, but he will claim all the credit for himself. It's the new president of South Korea and the dictator in North Korea who are much more to be credited with this sort of thing if there is a peace. And it's also not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to be over a long period of time. I wouldn't be shocked if it's 10 years till you got to complete resolution of this. If things fall apart, if Donald is played by then, you know, Donald will, of course, denounce everybody else because, remember, this is a man who will claims to be a Christian, so he was asked once, well, what did you last ask God for forgiveness for? And Trump said, well, I've never asked God for forgiveness. Why would I? I've never done anything that would require asking for forgiveness. Donald never takes responsibility. Never, ever, ever.
Well, there's such a flagrant inconsistency here. In 2 weeks' time, Trump is going to pull out of the JCPOA, the P5 plus one deal with Iran, on the basis that the deal only concentrates and only deals with nuclear weapons. It doesn't deal with Iran's behavior in Iraq, Syria, and in Lebanon.
Right.
Well, he's doing exactly the opposite with the North Koreans. He's making a deal over the so-called denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, whatever that means,
but
won't talk about...
He's not going to talk about
human rights and all of the other issues and the fact that North Korea, counterfeits $100 bills and deals drugs, etc. So there you have it. It's so flagrant that...
That's because Donald has no... philosophy. He, in fact, has said his entire life philosophy can be reduced to a single word, revenge. It's in his book, Think Big. It's in talks he gave that were videotaped or audiotaped. It's in interviews that he's given. His life's philosophy is revenge. Donald knows nothing of geopolitics. This is a man who, on his first foreign trip as president, goes to Saudi Arabia and praises the Saudis for fighting against terrorism when they fund what the U.S. State Department says are 59 of the 61 terrorist groups in the Middle East. He attacks Qatar, which has the U.S. has its most important base in, and where, we learned later, the Qataris declined to give his son-in-law a loan to bail the Kushner family out of 666 Fifth Avenue. Understand that Donald Trump is the third generation head of a crime family. The Trumps have been a crime family since the late 19th century. Grandpa Trump was a pimp who ran whorehouses in Washington State and the Yukon Territory, and later we don't know what kind of criminal enterprises, but he worked out of a tobacco shop in New York and yet had a great income. Well, he didn't get it from selling cigarettes and chewing tobacco. Fred Trump was a thief and had as his business partner an associate of the Gambino and Genovese crime families named Willie Tomasello. And Donald Trump has been a thief and a con artist and a swindler his entire life. We have a criminal in the White House who, like most white-collar criminals, has never been indicted, never been arrested. Most criminals don't ever get caught. It's just the dumb ones who'd commit stupid street crimes who get caught. Sophisticated criminals walk all the time. And Donald would see no contradiction between Iran and South Korea. Donald has no idea that Iran is the most cultured, advanced society in that part of the world and is the natural leader in the Middle East, not the Saudis. He doesn't know a Sunni from a Shia. And you remember his campaign put out a brochure with a picture of an American Sikh that said under the caption, Muslim. These are ignoramuses.
Well, you in fact, it's in your books, about Donald Trump's relationship to a cocaine dealer when he was in the casino business
right.
in New Jersey.
Who lives in the sound of your voice now.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a dealer. He was he was an international cocaine trafficker. And I'll say to you what I've said many times. The things that Donald Trump did, and I have all the documents and the letters to back what I'm saying, the favors he did for him, the fact that this guy's case was transferred from Ohio to the courtroom of Marianne Trump Berry in New Jersey, Donald's sister, and that he only served 18 months while the mules who drove the drugs got 20 years, and Donald kept doing business with him, even though he should have lost his casino license for doing that, says one thing. It makes no sense whatsoever what he did unless he was in business with Joe Wechselbaum in the cocaine trafficking, in which case everything he did makes sense. And Donald, if you're listening, if you think I just slandered you, sue me.
Well, just in closing then, David K. Johnson, given that Ronny Jackson was called the Candy Man and was handing out
right.
drugs, is there a possibility that he also that is the core of their relationship, apart from the fact that he's a genial guy, although apparently the people that work for him thought he was pretty terrible, he was a kiss-up and a kick-down kind of guy.
Right.
What do you think is going on with Trump himself? I know he doesn't drink, but I was noticed in those debates with Hillary Clinton that he kept sniffing as though he had a cocaine habit. Do you think there's anything going on with his relationship with the Candy Man that somehow that's why they bonded?
Yeah, I want to word this very, very carefully. First of all, Ronny Jackson has no qualifications to run the VA, the second biggest federal agency. He has no management experience of any consequence. Running a 50-person medical office has nothing to do with running the second largest agency of the United States government. He's also the doctor who said Donald had grown an inch to 6'3", and more significantly, that he only weighs 239 pounds. Anybody who believes Donald Trump only weighs 239 pounds, which put him, you know, just below the morbid obesity index or somewhere, I forget the exact measure, that's absurd. Just take a look at the man. He clearly weighs more than that. So he curried favor with Trump, as he's done, by the way, with some of the previous presidents who he was the physician for. Now, on the issue of Donald does not drink, Donald, we know, was seeing a Dr. Feelgood who gave him shots back in the 1980s. And Donald, this is to goes to your question about Donald's sniffing and his behavior, particularly in the first debate where he got lost at the end and wandered off into nowhere land. Donald says he does not use drugs, and I do not have any verifiable evidence to the contrary. The important word there being verifiable evidence.
Well, David K. Johnson, I thank you for joining us, and we will definitely stay in touch.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investor, reporter, and bestselling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He has lectured on economics, journalism, and tax policy on every continent except Antarctica, and is a former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and he recently co-founded DC Report. And his latest book just out is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into whether Kim Jong-un's charm offensive undercuts Trump's leverage. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia, the editor of the ASEAN Forum. He's also the author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations, and North Korea and Mongolia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gilbert Rosman.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you, Gilbert. And do you think that this charm offensive that's just taken place with the North Korean and the South Korean leaders, you know, sort of skipping across from one country to the other and then sitting down at a picnic table, and the North Korean press did show a lot of it with color pictures, which is unusual in the rather drab newspapers. They didn't mention anything about the nuclear deals or the promises of denuclearization. But in the South, there was a great deal of celebration some of it very emotional. So if they're going to proceed with the thawing and basically ending the Korean War, how can Donald Trump maintain the leverage of military threats when the Koreas are talking peace? And how can he maintain sanctions if the South and the North want to open up and start trading again?
Well, Trump wants to make this all about himself, how he has created an atmosphere where everything has changed, and now he's in the driver's seat, and he can turn on or off the diplomacy. But I think this is mostly about Kim Jong-un, who's strengthened his position with his nuclear and missile test last year, and now is turning to diplomacy, where he has quite a few instruments. The great desire in South Korea's part to, particularly with this leader, to pursue diplomacy, to start a process of reconciliation and even reunification. The desire of China and Russia to create an atmosphere where this isn't about military pressure, but this is about some kind of multilateral negotiations and compromise on geopolitics. So I don't think Trump really had that much chance of using military pressure before. The damage would have been enormous, and nobody would have approved of it in the region. And now his chances of using it are more limited. Now the challenge is to keep the sanctions going in such a way that he can get the pressure to have the negotiations go forward somewhat the way the United States wants them to.
So are you saying that Kim Jong-un is playing Trump?
Yeah, of course. I think this is a strategy of Kim Jong-un from months ago, and that he waited for the Winter Olympics and made a decision about how he would use South Korea to get to Trump. But, of course, that is, and he understood who Trump is and how flattery works, and Moon Jae-in gives all the credit to Trump for bringing these negotiations out and making them possible when that isn't the case. But that this is part of a game. They want Trump to make a deal, and so they are, both Moon and Kim, for rather different reasons, are trying to influence how Trump will proceed.
Well, it certainly appears that there's a flagrant inconsistency here, because in 2 weeks' time, Trump is going to pull out of the Iran deal, which he rejects because it's only about nuclear weapons and not about Iran's behavior in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. At the same time, he's entering a deal with North Korea, which is all about nuclear weapons and no discussions of human rights abuses in North Korea, the gulags, the counterfeiting of $100 bills and the distribution of drugs around the world. So there you have it. I mean, I guess when you have the former head of the National Security Agency and the CIA writing a piece in Sunday's New York Times saying the end of intelligence, because we have a president who is not interested in facts. Inconsistencies, I suppose, are small change in that context.
Well, this is a new environment, and I don't think many appreciate that this is the third or fourth stage in multilateral maneuvering to see what the future of the Korean Peninsula will be, which matters a great deal to a lot of parties, to see what how to manage or eliminate the nuclear threat from North Korea. I think the chances of managing it are far greater than eliminating it. My guess is that Trump will agree to a deal which is far worse than the Iran deal, but would be the deal that's possible and which would have the appearance of being something that would lead to full denuclearization. And Trump could say, I had a huge success. My guess is that the problem with North Korea's regional behavior will appear to be resolved for a time, whereas Iran's regional behavior is indeed an issue that is bothering a lot of people in the American security establishment. As far as human rights are concerned, we know that that's not a priority for Trump. It wasn't a priority in dealing with Iran, and it certainly won't be with dealing with North Korea. But besides, when you have a possibility of war, possibility of one of the worst, if not the worst, conflict that has occurred since the Vietnam War, or maybe even earlier, you do think that if you can get a way of resolving it, even if you can't deal with some of the side issues, you're doing something good.
Let's talk a little bit about the neighborhood that you specialize in, Gilbert. What's your sense of already the Russians are congratulating the two North and South Korean leaders for their summit meeting, as are the Chinese? There's no love lost between China and North Korea. And in spite of the fact that the U.S. has been pounding China for years to get our irons out of the fire vis-a-vis North Korea, so they have the magic bullet when it comes to Kim Jong-un, it's pretty clear that they don't.
Well, I think we shouldn't underestimate how important China is in this process and how much they have driven North Korea to the talks. I mean, Trump wants to say it's his military threat. I think it's far more likely that two other factors mattered. One, Kim Jong-un's success in developing missiles and nuclear weapons, giving him a sense of better bargaining position, and two, China's intense sanctions that have crippled and increasingly have dire consequences for North Korea. So China really is in the driver's seat in some way. They can reduce the sanctions or intensify the sanctions. They can insist that their views are heard in the negotiations. After all, Kim Jong-un recognized that he needed to work with China and quickly made a trip to China at the end of March after he realized that he would be holding a summit with Trump by spring's end. So we shouldn't assume that this is a three-party negotiation with South Korea or a two-party negotiation. When push comes to shove, China will be more important than anyone else, I think, in this process, because they have so much leverage over what happens.
And what do you make of the discussion that apparently took place between Kim Jong-un and President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, where Kim said he would abandon his nuclear weapons if the United States agreed to formally end the Korean War and promise not to invade his country?
Well, I think there are elements there that are not left very clear. He will pledge, it seems clear when he meets Trump, total denuclearization. But each step of the way will require rewards. And each step of the way he can pull back and say, well, we haven't received what we require, and therefore we won't proceed to the next step. Meanwhile, it's going to be very hard to verify where some of the nuclear weapons are hidden. This is a long, drawn-out process, we can assume, going on years. And in that, Kim Dae-jung can have a lot of sympathy and cooperation with the South Koreans, can draw on differences among the countries involved, particularly China and Russia seeking a different outcome in terms of the U.S.-South Korea alliance. So I don't think that Kim Jong-un is promising to do exactly what some Americans and maybe Trump are interpreting he will do.
Well, John Bolton, the new National Security Advisor, is saying that the North Koreans are expected to have full, complete, total disclosure of everything related to their nuclear program with a full international verification. You're not holding your breath on that, I take it.
No, I think there'll be some declaration and some verification, and it'll be very hard to know what is full. There is a one wild card here, and that is that North Korea may be so worried about China and Sino-centrism and trying to create a different regional order that they may do more than people expect, because they think they will, the regime will be preserved and South Korea will be their strong advocate, and the United States will see North Korea as a partner versus China, and maybe even in the process not be very concerned about the last stages of North Korea's nuclear weapons, because they think that it's too important to keep North Korea as a partner. So I think there's just too much left unclear for Bolton to conclude that this is exactly what North Korea will do.
Yeah, but are you saying, Gilbert Rosman, that the North Koreans could play the triangulation game that Nixon played when he visited China and was able to play China off against Russia and be in the catbird seat? Is that possible, that Kim Jong-un could be in the catbird seat playing the U.S. off against China?
We're dealing with the strategic triangle of three great powers in the 1970s, and we're dealing with a very weak North Korea except for its weapons. So I wouldn't say it's in the catbird seat, but if North Korea decides that it wants to make this into a triangle and wants to build up ties with the United States by getting the Chinese, the U.S., to think of North Korea as a bulwark against China, that is one option. But it's not one easily played, because North Korea depends for 90% or more of its trade on China. North Korea's long border is with China. North Korea, China has so many ways of influencing not only North Korea, but South Korea. So, no, I don't think this is a very precise comparison with the early 1970s, except to say that countries try to take advantage of differences and rivalries, among others, to gain an advantage in their ability to work and create a settlement in these kinds of negotiations.
But if the North Koreans cut ties with China on their northern border, well, you said they can't. But what could they? Could their ties be replaced by their southern border with South Korea?
Well, South Korea is very vulnerable to China too. China accounts for much more trade in South Korea. China has just had informal sanctions against South Korea for the deployment of the long-range missiles called THAAD, and South Korea's lost already about $10 billion in that process, and those sanctions aren't completely removed right now. So if North Korea try to say, okay, we're going to try to be hostile to China and form a partnership against China, that would not work. I'm just saying, to a degree, North Korea can try to convince the United States that it should be soft on North Korea, because North Korea serves in some way as a way for the U.S. to limit China's reach.
Well, obviously, if there's a relaxation and if the Korean War is declared over, and if trade with the South blossoms, my sense would be that how does Kim hold on to this regime, the glue of which is paranoia about invasion. He's got this oversized standing army. He's got thousands and thousands of these generals with all their ribbons and medals that, you know, can barely, you know, the fabric is fraying from the weight of these medals. It would seem that, you know, they've also got all of those artillery tubes and rockets pointed at Seoul. How could Kim open up his country without losing control, which is absolute from cradle to grave? They have total, they don't have just physical control over their people, they have mental control over their people.
You're asking a very telling question. I mean, this is a very difficult process. But the first thing Kim would want is a sympathetic leader in South Korea who will say, I'm going to do everything possible to prop up your regime. I'm not going to put pressure on your regime. We're going to work with you and not in any way suggest that our goal is to undermine you. And the second thing he would want is for Donald Trump to say, you're giving us what we really wanted, even if we can't be sure of that for a long time, and we're prepared to make it easier for you to make this transition. Will the transition be possible? It might not be. But it would have to involve a lot of guarantees for the bad guys in North Korea, a lot of money. There have to be all kinds of things that will prop up this regime in return for the deal that's being made. I think Kim Jong-un, has already given some thought to what he wants from them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Gilbert Rosman.
It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in the societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia, the editor of the ASEAN Forum. He's the author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations and North Korea and Mongolia. We're going to take a brief station break and be looking further into the extent to which Kim Jong-un is playing Donald Trump.
I wanted to walk through the empty streets and feel something constant under my feet, but all the news reports recommended that I stay indoors, because the air outside will make our cells divide.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And Gilbert Rosman brought up the possibility of some form of triangulation that the North could engage in, playing China off against America. Is there any possibility in your mind? I mean, obviously the analogy with Nixon's triangulation during the 70s, playing China off against Russia, that's a bit of a stretch. But is there any possibility of that?
I have looked in vain for any evidence-supported precedent by which China was able to coerce North Korea in any meaningful way. For example, get North Korea to back down, not shoot at American planes, blow it up, and kill everyone on board, all 31 servicemen, as North Korea did in 1969. And always in these cases, China, despite expressing some displeasure against North Korea, increased aid to North Korea to placate North Korea. And one might argue that is the adult approach to grit its teeth and appease North Korea, because in the long term, it's in China's interest to keep North Korea around. With respect to Nixon's visit to China, there is a lot of misperception. Many people want to believe in this enduring myth that ping-pong diplomacy paved the way when American table tennis players were dramatically all of a sudden invited to come to Beijing in April 1971, and just 3 months later, Henry Kissinger showed up in Beijing. But the two events are not married by cause and effect. In fact, there were some 18 months of secret negotiations between the U.S. and China, principally through their respective embassies in Warsaw, Poland. Why? Because of the common threat of the Soviet Union, because Nixon wanted to create the excitement of finding, winning China back, as he was hopelessly losing Indochina, and because Mao wanted Taiwan's seat in the UN Security Council, and so on. With respect to U.S. and North Korea rapprochement, if there is to be one, there are no such entangling, there is no such convergence of interests. One side wants North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. The other side wants to keep the weapons that the state has assiduously worked to develop. So there is a bit of a problem there in terms of what each side is seeking.
Well, I find it hard to believe that Kim Jong-un will open up his country in terms of the sunshine policy. In spite of the pageantry and the theatrics of the meeting that just took place at Panmunjom on the border, stepping back and forth across and then having that sort of picnic by the picnic tables. And, at the end of the day, what is the likelihood of the North Koreans giving up this massive outsized standing army, firing thousands of these bemedaled generals and removing hundreds of thousands of rockets and artillery tubes targeted at Seoul?
I am shocked to hear you are not moved by the gripping optics of Kim Jong-un smiling for the cameras. Seriously,
well,
one would never entertain for a minute the presumption that it is within the realm of the possible to get any of the eight other nuclear weapon states, the permanent members of the Security Council, and India, Pakistan, and Israel to give it up through conventional nuclear diplomacy. But when it comes to North Korea, we still want to harbor that illusion, that hope, because North Korea is so backward, has little else. Maybe it is possible. I've always posited precisely for those very same reasons, because North Korea has little else other than military power. It's exceedingly unlikely. One has to return to the basic question of causation. What explains Kim Jong-un's dramatic outreach as of January? Did he wake up one day on New Year's Day and have a moment of epiphany and decided he's going to be a nice guy going forward? Few people would believe that. Then did Mr. Moon, the South Korean president, his patience through Kim Jong-un's year-long bluster, did that move Kim Jong-un? He was so gratified, he wanted to reciprocate and put on some good behavior. Probably unlikely. Did Trump's verbal threats of fire and fury and total destruction cower Kim Jong-un to change? Highly unlikely in view of the fact that Kim Jong-un, with each of those threats, fired off a missile, conducted a thermonuclear test on September 3rd, fired an ICBM in late November. So the only logical conclusion that I'm able to draw is that this is all premeditated. It's been planned. Why? What is my basis? Because his daddy did virtually the identical things that Kim Jong-un is doing as of 2000. Called for a meeting with the South Korean president, paid his first visit to China a couple of weeks before the meeting in late May, 6 years after coming into power, just as Kim Jong-un did in late March, 6 years after assuming power. then called on the U.S., Bill Clinton, to visit Pyongyang. And Clinton, we know, was very keen on it but could not make the trip. And then visited Vladimir Putin in Moscow in August 2001. Next year, received the Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi in Pyongyang. And this is an elaborate process by which the North Korean funny-looking dictator comes to be acknowledged, accepted as a legitimate leader of not such an abnormal country. It's all very elaborate and well thought out.
Well, Trump is already claiming success for the bad haircut summit, which hasn't happened yet. So it's pretty extraordinary what's going on. And you basically have two sort of narcissistic sociopaths sitting down together. And I don't believe Trump will sign anything that makes him look good. And I'm sure the North Korean leader knows that. But that doesn't mean Trump won't get a Nobel Peace Prize and get reelected. So forgive me for being so cynical, Sung Yoon Lee, but what happened between the... Because Trump recently took credit for extraordinary number of things, including the South Korean Winter Olympics. He took credit for that. But I recall that the Vice President Pence made remarks about human rights abuses in North Korea, which offended the North Koreans, and they refused to shake hands, and they sat, as you see from the pictures, behind each one, behind the other, in a kind of frozen attitude. And then shortly thereafter, it suddenly reversed itself. And we know this strange meeting took place at the White House, where the head of South Korea's intelligence service, along with the national security advisor, were in the executive office building, and suddenly they were called over to the White House, and they basically said that they had a good meeting with Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang, and he was open to an American visit. And immediately Trump said, I'm ready for a summit. So, and that shocked everybody. So what do you think happened in that very short time frame, the turnaround from Mike Pence's frozen meeting, non-meeting with the North Korean delegation at the Olympics, and this opening?
Hubris and the temptation to carve out some kind of a positive North Korea legacy were given an opportunity by Kim Jong-un's proposition for a date, for a summit meeting. So as you mentioned, Mike Pence, attending the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics in early February, brought with him the parents of Otto Warmbier, the college student who was beaten, tortured, and came home in a coma 1.5 years after his detainment and died a few days after coming home. And Mike Pence said that North Korea's outreach to the South is, quote, a charade. It's all a ploy. It's fake. So I am a bit puzzled as to at what point between February 9th, the opening ceremony, and March 8th, when the South Korean envoys, as you mentioned, conveyed to President Trump Kim Jong-un's invitation for a summit. During that brief span of 27 or 8 days, at what point did Kim Jong-un's intentions morph from fake to sincere? This is a very basic question of logic that President Trump needs to ask himself. Previously, American officials, government officials, journalists, academics who have met with Kim the first, second, and this one too, Mike Pompeo, we know, met with him less than a month ago, have all uniformly come away very impressed at the fact that the North Korean dictator is not only not a raving lunatic, not crazy, but actually quite measured, self-effacing, has a sense of humor, knowledgeable, well-prepared, as Pompeo said of Kim Jong-un. And they come away from these meetings utterly impressed and convinced that they have gained some new deep insight into the nature of the regime, mostly by virtue of their own charisma, magnetic personality, and empathy. Such is the tendency to patronize North Korea. I fear President Trump will sit down with a North Korean tyrant, utterly unprepared, and convinced that he has somehow connected with Kim Jong-un, that he has been able to tame the North Korean leader. That's a trap.
Well, on the other hand, the Korean War could end, and the success at the summit, whether it's a real success or not, the cosmetics may be sufficient to, as I say, get Trump the Nobel Peace Prize and re-elected. So one can't underestimate the possibility, of that happening. But you've made the case that that the North Koreans have just about reneged on every deal that they've made. But it's also true on the other side that the U.S. hasn't been the most reliable partner. I mean, under Clinton, they agreed to get rid of their heavy water reactor that was creating, making plutonium and replace it with a light water reactor along with fuel oil. And the Republicans under Newt Gingrich scuttled that deal. So are the North Koreans, do they have a case of that the U.S. may not be the most reliable person to negotiate with?
Well, North Koreans would be crazy if they were to place full faith, full trust in what Americans say, and vice versa, of course. However, during those years, from 1995 to 2008, so for much of the Clinton George W. Bush continuum, the U.S. gave North Korea more than $1.3 billion in aid, all for North Korea's lies, repeated lies of denuclearization. So that's about $100 million a year flowing into North Korea's coffers, which is a pretty good deal from the regime's point of view. That's what North Korea seeks. Moreover, North Korea wants to get Trump to concede, give other concessions like stop enforcing sanctions, which is crimping in style. And in the meantime, buy time and money, I guess, with which to perfect his own nuclear posture review. So all these gestures, verbal palliative that is amenable to denuclearization talks, and his willingness to shut down the main nuclear site in the northeastern corner of his nation. These are great, but they're, they make for good theatrics. But when you've seen Rambo 1, 2, and 3 repeatedly, by the time Rambo 4 comes around, you have a pretty good idea how things will turn out.
But Trump is laying the groundwork. I mean, he blames everything on his predecessor, particularly Barack Obama, but he's blaming the North Korean-South Korean Cold War since 1953 on his predecessors. I guess that includes Clinton and George W. Bush. And is basically saying, I'm going to fix a problem that my predecessors have failed. So he's already staking out a pretty high bar there, don't you think?
Trump's predecessors do deserve blame for their failure to denuclearize North Korea. But of course, this is a very difficult calling. We're not talking about shrimp quota trade negotiations, no offense. But, I mean, nuclear diplomacy, short of waging war, is international politics played at the highest level. At the same time, none of his predecessors walked right into this kind of elaborate trap set by the North Korean leader and legitimated the North Korean leader by holding a summit meeting with him. A summit meeting very much unlike a blind date or a family reunion, inherent deficiencies in both notwithstanding, pardon me, but a summit meeting is the culmination, really, the culmination of months, if not years, of tough negotiations. You have to reach an agreement on the key issues at hand, even between allies. A summit meeting should come at the end of that lengthy, protracted, difficult process, not at the start, and then start negotiating. So Trump is really walking right into this trap, which may be quite damaging to U.S. interests, more so than not negotiating at all.
Well, in the last couple of minutes, does that make the South Koreans the adults in the room? I mean, obviously you have this situation. We've got in the North, you've basically got the tyranny of the weak, who are able to leverage these nuclear weapons. Maybe they've got a dozen or so. We don't know whether they could actually couple them with these long-range missiles, but at this point, the U.S. intelligence services have accepted the possibility that the North Koreans could target at least a dozen major American cities, and that is completely unacceptable. So they've got our attention, shall we say. But on the other side, you've got a lot of idealism, the optics coming out of South Korea of these people in the street watching these giant jumbo screens is a very emotional moment for the South Koreans. So I guess my question would be, is North, the tyranny of the weak in the North, going to con the idealism of the South?
South Koreans are more than eager to be duped because it's quite uplifting whenever there is inter-Korean contact, especially at the highest level. And admittedly, South Korea has far more to lose in escalating tension with North Korea than the other side. So there's just simply no stomach on the part of the government or the public, more importantly, to escalate tit for tat. And the preferred option, the default position is always to de-escalate and placate and give more money to North Korea. At the same time, I would say South Korea is more playing a supporting role to North Korea's post-provocation peace ploy phase and deserves some blame for that. President Moon, in my humble opinion, went way overboard in hosting Kim Jong-un and his royal family, did not bring up any substantive issues like human rights or process by which North Korea would denuclearize North Korea instead of the Korean Peninsula, as it's always said. And the two men joining hands, walking hand in hand, side by side, to and fro across the militarized border, affectionately. I mean, that makes for great optics, but it's eerily reminiscent of the final scene, the final lines of Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, when one of the twin clowns, upon finding his long-lost brother, says, "We came into the world like brother and brother, and now let's go hand in hand, not one before another." The two men are not brothers. They are not friends. They are adversaries. North Korea is engaged in a long-term systemic contest for survival against the more attractive, legitimate Korean state. I think the South Korean government needs to be aware of that.
Well, Sung-Yoon Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Kathleen Ash. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.